Well, as you heard him say, Bach, to be more precise, the gavotte from J.S. Bach's Partita number 3 in E major. Nikolai Znaider joking that he likes to stick to one key a night. Well, we've had one Mendelssohn UK premiere tonight already, the original version of the overture Ruy Blas, and after the interval, we've two more. The original version of the overture, the Fair Melusina, and likewise of Mendelssohn's Fifth Symphony, the Reformation. Nikolai Znaider applauding the audience now and giving them a cheerful thumbs up. A cheerful little wave as he leaves the platform for the last time. And it is time now for us to join Rana Mitter and his guest for tonight's Proms Plus Literary event, recorded earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music, just across the road from us here at the Royal Albert Hall.
Hello, and today our prom is dominated by that compelling figure of romantic music, Felix Mendelssohn. To tell us more about his life and work, Professor John Dethridge of King's College London joins me here. And we'll also hear readings from the actors Lisa Dillon, whom you'll know from television's wonderful Cranford, and Charles Aitken of the Royal Shakespeare Company. Now, John, one of the things we know about Mendelssohn is that he was a child prodigy, wasn't he?
Yes, there are a lot of child prodigies in music history, but he's unusual. Not like Mozart, his parents didn't actually want him to take up music, unlike Mozart, who was exploited. He also, by the time he was 14, had written over 200 compositions, and some of these are still played today. Now, you can't say that of all child prodigies. So
it's almost like sort of childhood rebellion, being told not to and deciding he was going
to
do it
yes,
anyway.
Well, yes, I mean, I think there is something rebellious about Mendelssohn, in the sense if you have your dad telling you to study law and you say, no, Dad, I want to do music, and then actually getting away with it in the end. And also, by the way, his dad said you mustn't use the name Mendelssohn, even. Had visiting cards printed where it said Felix M. Bartholdy, and Felix said, no, sorry, it's got to be Mendelssohn Bartholdy.
And yet, in some ways, of course, the connections which his father made for him were of great importance. And I'm thinking here of a childhood meeting with one of the truly great figures of European culture, and that, of course, is Goethe, who I think he met aged 12. Mendelssohn aged 12, not Goethe aged 12.
Yes, yes. He first met him quite young, and Goethe was immediately impressed with him, because I think even at the age of 12, it was obvious that Mendelssohn had quite a lot of political cunning and knew who he was talking to, because Goethe found that he could actually have a conversation with this young person, and the more they met through the 1820s, then the more he realised that.
It's extraordinary to think of these two different phases of European culture sort of meeting during that brief period. And of course, one of the things that Mendelssohn was doing for Goethe was teaching him the history of music.
Yes, Goethe is someone who would talk about anything. I mean, if you read his voluminous collected writings, he even talks about his dentist at one point. But on music, he wrote quite a bit about music, but he always said he was a bit careful about talking about music. So he was particularly interested to hear from Felix, the first-rate Felix, as he called him, about the history of music.
Well, I think we've actually got a record of Goethe writing about one of these lessons in the history of music, and I think we can hear that now from Charles.
June 3rd, 1830. A few minutes ago, at 9:30 this morning, the first-rate Felix left after spending a cheerful fortnight with us and delighting everyone with his accomplished, lovable art. To me, his presence was especially beneficial, for I found that my relation to music is still the same as ever. I listen to it with pleasure, interest, and reflection, and I love the historical part of it. Who can understand any kind of occurrence if they are not thoroughly acquainted with its development down to the present time? What was great for me was that Felix understood this progressive advancement admirably, and luckily his excellent memory enables him to call before him at will every kind of example. Beginning with the Bach epoch, He brought Haydn, Mozart, and Gluck to life again for me, gave me a fairly good impression of the great masters of technique in more modern times, and finally led me to experience and contemplate his own compositions. And so he parted from me with my fervent blessing.
Now, what's going on there is something, John, that to us perhaps seems very familiar, which is the idea of trying to understand music through its history. And yet, at that time, this was actually rather an original thing to do.
Well, yes, it was unusual. The first thing is that Goethe is still learning, isn't he, at age 80. I think it's really quite remarkable. He wants to really know. And he's also picked up the idea, which was becoming current, that you can only understand music really, especially the latest, historically, that it comes from somewhere and is making progress up to the present time. And I think he found that quite a good way of trying to understand music. He was very interested in the effect of music on people and knew that there was quite a lot to talk about it, but didn't think his literary abilities were enough always to talk about it. And you have Mendelssohn here playing the pedagogue, really, at the piano. He always love playing to people the piano and teaching them something about music, because he had so much music in his head that he could call on as well, as Goethe says.
I mean, this is something that really characterises Mendelssohn. He's someone who, at this point, in a very short number of years, really had a very strong engagement with, you know, the whole history, the legacy of the musical tradition.
Yes, I think he's one of the founders, really, of the idea of German music in the historical sense. And don't forget, by this point, he'd already introduced the St. Matthew Passion to a very distinguished audience in Berlin. And it put Mendelssohn on the map already as someone who was a Bach expert. But I have to say, he wasn't interested in Bach for antiquarian reasons. This is not someone who wants to do an authentic performance of Bach. In fact, it was with piano and with big chorus and so forth. He was interested, really, in doing older music in order to justify his own compositions, saying, I come from this tradition.
Well, that brings us to a very important point, I think, in terms of our assessment of Mendelssohn, because the accusation that is brought up against him, both at the time and in the centuries since, is that ultimately he fails to quite hit the top level of greatness because of an innate conservatism. I'm rather nervous seeing a whole bunch of Mendelssohn fans here in the audience, but I will risk putting that point of view. Do you think there's any fairness in that at all?
No, I don't think it's fair at all. I think he saw himself as a progressive, as someone who was carrying on from Beethoven, and I think he really did. I think this is a myth put out by a number of composers who came after Mendelssohn, including our friend Richard Wagner. But in fact, Mendelssohn, in the past few years even, is now, I think, more widely appreciated for doing really very innovative things, creating new forms and creating quite marvellous pieces. Good, he's uneven. You know, he can create the bad piece just like the next composer.
Well, speaking of innovation, one of the things that perhaps is less well known about Mendelssohn is that he loved to improvise to his friends at the piano, no doubt with some instruction in mind as well. And one of the people to whom he improvised was no less a personage than Queen Victoria. And we can actually hear a reading about this from Queen Victoria's diaries. Lisa.
6th of June, 1842, Buckingham Palace. After dinner came Mendelssohn Bartholdy, whose acquaintance I was so anxious to make. Albert had already seen him the other morning. He is short, dark, and Jewish-looking, delicate, and with a fine intellectual forehead. I should say he must be about 35 or 6. He is very pleasing and modest, and is greatly protected by the King of Prussia. He played first of all some of his Lieder ohne Worte, after which his serenade, and then he asked us to give him a theme upon which he could improvise. We gave him a Rule Britannia and the Austrian national anthem. He began immediately, and really, I have never heard anything so beautiful, the way in which he blended them both together and changed over from one to the other. Was quite wonderful, as well as the exquisite harmony and feeling he puts into the variations, and the powerful, rich chords and modulations which reminded me of all his beautiful compositions. At one moment, he played the Austrian national anthem with the right hand. He played Rule Britannia as the bass with his left. He made some further improvisations on well-known tunes and songs. We were all filled with the greatest admiration. Poor Mendelssohn was quite exhausted when he had done playing.
Lisa, thank you. And that reading was really so intriguing that we thought we couldn't resist asking John Dethridge if he wouldn't mind recreating that moment for us on the piano here. I'm sure Queen Victoria would have been delighted, John. Thank you so much.
That's a guess of what it might have sounded like.
Sounded very convincing to everyone here, I think. And actually, thinking back to that diary entry when she was describing that musical moment, I mean, this was a queen who really knew her music, wasn't she?
Oh, yes. I think she was something of an expert, played the piano herself with Albert. In fact, Mendelssohn arranged two of the Song Without Words for the both of them, and Queen Victoria has the simpler part at the top, and Albert has the bottom. But what's interesting when you play them is that Mendelssohn has done it in such a way that they keep touching hands. You have to keep touching hands with the thing as you go up the keyboard and down again. So he really knew about the intimacy of the two.
Now, a lot of Mendelssohn's music we think of as perhaps associated with a particular idea or image, I mean, Fingal's Cave, Hebrides, and so forth. But you've mentioned the Songs Without Words, the Lieder ohne Worte, and these, in a sense, are famous precisely for not being attached to words, to images in that way.
Yes, the idea may have come from his sister, actually, who had this idea of creating songs, but without a text. What is, I think, quite interesting is that these were very popular at the time, during Mendelssohn's lifetime, but sometimes people would write to him and say, well, what are you thinking? What were you thinking about when you wrote this music? Is there a text? And a relative of his, Suchet, who is the cousin of his wife, actually wrote him a long letter saying, what did you mean? And then suggesting some words to it. Mendelssohn's reply to this is really extremely interesting.
And we can hear that reply right now. Mendelssohn's letter to Marc-André Suchet, read for us by Charles.
Berlin, October 15th, 1842. There is so much talk about music, and yet so little is said. For my part, I believe that words do not suffice for such a purpose. And if I found they did suffice, I would finally have nothing more to do with music. People often complain that music is too ambiguous, that what they should think when they hear it is so unclear, whereas everyone understands words. With me, it is exactly the reverse. And not only with regard to an entire speech, but also with individual words. These two seem to me so ambiguous, so vague, so easily misunderstood in comparison to genuine music, which fills the soul with a thousand things better than words. The thoughts which are expressed to me by music that I love are not too indefinite to be put into words, but on the contrary, too definite. If you ask me what I was thinking of when I wrote my songs without words, I would say, just the songs as they stand.
John, how original at that time was this idea of music being more abstract, not being tied to any kind of image or particular idea?
It's not new, but mostly up to this point, it was generally agreed that music could be associated with something outside of itself. But what's interesting about this is that if you see it in a wider context, Mendelssohn is really prevaricating a little bit, because the truth is that he was someone who was always inspired by images and by words, always wanted to write an opera. He did write a 2.5-hour opera when he was younger, but he thought it was not very good, and he was absolutely right about that. He was a good critic of himself.
Am I right in thinking he actually walked out of the first performance?
He walked out of the first performance. He was so disgusted with his own opera. But that doesn't necessarily mean that he wasn't interested in writing one. And we know that he wrote many programmatic overtures, Fingal's Cave, where you almost can feel Mendelssohn getting seasick on the sea, can't you?
Now, speaking of the writing of operas, there is a very intriguing musical, What Might Have Been, alternative history, because Mendelssohn did seriously consider writing an opera based on the myth of the Nibelungs. And we actually have a reading from his writing about that. Charles.
November 14th, 1840. My best thanks for your last letter. Do you know that your thoughts about the Nibelungen practically glow on the page? I haven't been able to get them out of my head since. I want to spend the first of my free days reading the poem. I've forgotten the details and can only recall the general outline and colouring of it, which seemed to me gloriously dramatic. Could you do me the favour of telling me your ideas in more detail? I scarcely remember what your allusion to the sinking into the Rhine stands for. Could you point out to me the various passages which struck you as particularly dramatic when the idea first occurred to you? And above all, could you be more specific about the whole concept, because its images and character have made a strong impression on my imagination? I beg you to do it, and do it soon. It will help me a great deal.
And if that the tone of that letter is shot through with deep love and affection, that's not surprising, because it was, in fact, written to Mendelssohn's sister, Fanny. And that idea of writing an opera was not just Felix, was it? She herself, Fanny, also thought about writing an opera.
I think it's clear from her reply, which we'll hear in a minute, that she herself was considering writing an opera on the Nibelungen, no less.
Well, in that case, I think we should turn to Lisa to hear the letter from Fanny to her brother Felix.
5th of December, 1840. I'm really glad about your lively interest in the Nibelungen idea. You're probably further along with your plans by now than I ever was. All I ever did was to think about the characters and the whole situation rather than a specific sequence of scenes. The greatest difficulty is probably the ending. No opera can end with such violent butchery. But how else? The sinking of the Nibelung horde goes like this. After Hagen has murdered Siegfried, he looks with envy on Krimhilde's great treasure, which, if I'm not mistaken, she has ordered to be brought from the land of the Nibelungs. Hagen is afraid that she'll use it to buy friends and avengers, so he snatches it away from her and sinks it into the Rhine. Please let me know now and then, how you're getting on with it all.
Well, the Mendelssohn ring, whether by Felix or by Fanny, was never to be, but history records that another guy, someone called Richard Wagner, did in fact make good on that particular story. And the other thing, of course, we know is that Wagner had strong opinions on Mendelssohn, and Mendelssohn's reputation has suffered because of Wagner's opinions, really, hasn't
it? Oh, yes. I mean, I think that these really quite perfidious arguments against Mendelssohn, that he was interested in old music, for example, because he couldn't write anything original by himself, and because he was a Jew, he therefore could only write imitations. But I think one of the factors here on Wagner's part, apart from the really terrible arguments, anti-Semitic arguments against him, is that he learnt a great deal from Mendelssohn and wanted to cover over that fact. He did the same with Italian opera, he did the same with Berlioz.
Well, for some people, knowing that someone has influenced you is clearly grounds for great resentment. It does sound as if that's what was happening with Wagner and Mendelssohn. I have to say that that is all we have time for tonight, but I'd like to say thank you very much to Professor John Dethridge and to our readers tonight, Charles Aitken and Lisa Dillon. Thank you all very much.
Rana Mitter presented this evening's Proms Plus literary event, and the producer was Gavin Hurd. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall. That chanting tells you where we are, and the second part of the first of a pair of concerts being given at the 2012 Proms by the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra and their music director, Ricardo Chailly. And they're going to give us the two more Mendelssohn UK premieres I mentioned earlier, with the original version of an unfairly neglected concert overture he considered the most intimate thing he produced, Die Schöne Melusine, followed by the original version of his Reformation Symphony. Well, earlier on, I asked Ricardo Chailly how it felt to inherit Mendelssohn's own orchestra.
It was certainly a privilege and at the same time a big responsibility. And I thought, in which way should I go, bringing forward such a long-lasting tradition? And at the same time, I finally had the opportunity to receive the first print of a new edition from Bernreiter about the Urfassung and the early versions of Mendelssohn overtures and symphony, especially the Reformation Symphony, which we play tonight. Maestro Hogwood did take care of this critical edition, which are excellently printed, and that gave me the opportunity to reconsider my experience up to the time when I started, was 2005 in Leipzig, and restudy completely the whole series of overtures and symphonies of Mendelssohn in a complete different version, but at the same a complete different optical as interpreter. That was the fascination.
Ricardo Chailly, tonight's conductor. You do your best trying to give an account of a piece of music which you know your listeners can't know because it's brand new, and then the composer comes along and says that what you've said is a load of rubbish. Well, I'm glad to say that hasn't happened to me too often, but that was certainly how Mendelssohn described to his beloved sister Fanny what one German critic had to say about his overture, The Fair Melusine, going on about red coral, green sea beasts, magic castles and deep seas. The poor guy was only doing his best by a fairy story that probably then most Germans would at least have known. It's a story that's familiar to Germans, but not on this side of the Channel, though we might recognise Melusine as a relative of Dvořák's Rusalka. She's a water sprite who's allowed to marry a mortal on condition that she never reveals her true nature. She has to leave her knightly lover, Raimund, once a week to change back into mermaid form. And tragically, on one occasion, he catches her in the act. And this magical piece, Mendelssohn's watery imagery, gives us little foretastes of the rippling prelude to Wagner's opera, Das Rheingold. Here now is Ricardo Chailly to conduct the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra in Mendelssohn's overture, Die Schöne Melusine.
The Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra was conducted by Riccardo Chailly in the overture The Fair Melusine by Mendelssohn. And we heard there his original thoughts, reinstating a number of changes he made before the score came out in print in 1835. Ricardo Chailly returning to the platform and giving solo calls to the woodwind section. Well, for the final item in their programme, let's just get a little numbering thing out of the way. To begin with, Mendelssohn's Reformation Symphony was actually the second of his five mature symphonies for full orchestra that he composed. Immediately after it came the Italian. Well, they got numbered that way round because Mendelssohn didn't finish revising them until much later. That makes the symphony we're about to hear a work of his youth and not from later on in his short life. He died at just 38. Mendelssohn actually began work on the symphony when he was in Wales in September 1829, a few weeks after he made the first sketches for the Scottish Symphony during what was a very productive first visit to Britain. The Augsburg Confession, which the symphony commemorates, was the founding document of the Lutheran faith, which set out the principles of Protestantism in June 1530. In this symphony, Mendelssohn, who was a convert to Protestantism, presents a kind of programmatic account of the progress towards the triumph of the Reformation. The first movement evokes the solemn music of the Catholic Church, the serene style of Palestrina, without using a choir, of course. Then you find him apparently quoting from Wagner's Parsifal. It's actually the other way around. Mendelssohn brings in the Dresden Amen, which is now probably most familiar to us from Wagner's use of it as the Grail theme in his opera half a century after the premiere of Mendelssohn's Symphony. And to conduct Mendelssohn's Symphony No. 5, The Reformation, here is Ricardo Chailly.